think it's...
Hello and welcome to Should I Love This Comic? My name is Damien Drouet-Whiter.
And my name is Irigail Drouet-Whiter.
And we're here once again to answer the question, should I love this comic? Today we're back on our bordered comics, the ones with the special border for the 25th anniversary of Marvel Comics. And we're looking at Classic X-Men number 3, which had a cover date of November 1986 and was on sale on the 12th of August 1986. It features two stories, one called War Hunt, which originally appeared in X-Men number 95, which had a cover date of October 1975 and was on sale on the 22nd of July 1975. Ooh. Who else was on sale then? Well, not on sale, you'd just been born, hadn't you?
Which month did we say?
July 1975.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You were actually born in that month.
Yeah. I was.
And it also features additional material that's new, which obviously comes from the comic that was released in 1986. So we're going to talk about the two. I think what we should do is just go straight into the stories and go through a story, talk about it, and then go through the other story and talk about it.
Totally agree.
So let's start with the story War Hunt. It's plotted by Len Wein, it's scripted by Chris Claremont, it's penciled by Dave Cockrum, inked by Sam Granger, lettered by Karen Mantlow, and coloured by Petra Scottese. The editor was Marv Wolfman. But it does feature some additional material from 1986 that was written by Chris Claremont, penciled by Dave Cockrum, inked by Sam Granger, so the same penciler and inker, lettered by Bill Oakley, and coloured by Elaine Lee. And obviously edited by Ann Nocenti at that point. The new X-Men are on their way to Valhalla Air Base, where Count Nefaria disintegrated their plane. Nefaria and the Anni-Men have taken over America's strategic missile force and plan to extort millions from the president, or they will unleash Armageddon. The X-Men are falling through the air. Cyclops gets the two flying X-Men, Storm and Banshee, to help the others land safely. Colossus doesn't need saving, as he's invulnerable. But Storm rescues Wolverine and Nightcrawler, while Banshee saves Thunderbird. At the very last minute, Banshee returns to save Cyclops. Cyclops tells Nightcrawler to teleport inside and open a hatch, but Nightcrawler can't teleport blind. He could accidentally materialise inside a solid object and die. Banshee uses his sonic powers to find a clear space that Nightcrawler can teleport into. As soon as he does, Nightcrawler gets attacked by Frogman. Nightcrawler quickly defeats him and lets the other X-Men into the base. Nefarious releases gas into the tunnel, but the X-Men smash through to another tunnel. They then get attacked by the soldiers, who have been hypnotized by Dragonfly, the female Anni-Man. Storm calls up wind and rain to create a flood to wash the soldiers away. Thunderbird offers to go first, but Cyclops chooses Wolverine to go ahead, as he knows the base and can track people more effectively than Thunderbird. Thunderbird is very angry with himself for losing his temper, but he feels that there's nothing he can do that the others can't do better. The Animen attack. Ape Man picks up Thunderbird and throws him into Banshee, instantly knocking out two X-Men. Initially, the Animen are winning, but soon the X-Men defeat them by working together. Cyclops, Wolverine, Storm, Colossus and Nightcrawler go looking for Nefaria, but find he's locked the base into a self-destruct circuit. At the same time, a revived Banshee and Thunderbird see Nefaria escaping on his plane. Thunderbird jumps onto the wings as Nefaria takes off. Professor X appears psychically to let the X-Men know that their battle with the Animen conveniently destroyed the Doomsmith, so there is no risk of Armageddon, but there is an X-Man at risk outside. On the plane, Thunderbird begins to pull apart the aircraft, and even a psychic warning from the Professor isn't enough to make him jump to safety. The plane explodes, then crashes, and Professor X is in Thunderbird's mind as he burns to death. The forlorn X-Men walk away from the crash site, thinking about the inevitability of death in their business. The end. Actually, very little happened in that story. I managed to read out that summary quite quickly.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's an action story, isn't it? Mm. And it's actually the oldest comic that we've covered in this podcast.
Okay.
Because even though it was published in 1986, it's a reprint of something from 1975. So that's going back before anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it shows in many ways how comics have changed from 1975 to 1986.
Mm-hmm.
But should we go through our normal things that we discuss?
Yeah.
So those of you new to the podcast might not know, but we always look at five areas and we score the comic out of five, each of us,
mm-hmm.
on those five areas. So it, theoretically, a maximum score of 10 on each column, which would give us 50 points.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we don't get that high.
No.
So let's look at them first. And the areas are accessibility, artwork, characterization, cover, and acceptable in the 80s.
Mm.
Shall we start with accessibility?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you feel this was as a comic book to read, as someone who hadn't read this series before?
So like, I think I found it quite confusing. There were lots of unanswered questions, which I think are quite difficult to answer if you've not read the previous things.
I mean, it's definitely, it's part two of a two-part story.
Right, okay.
So the previous issue, which I did have back in the 80s, Classic X-Men number 2, had the first part of the story. And actually, the kind of behind-the-scenes story is Classic X-Men number 1 reprints Giant Size X-Men number 1.
Okay.
And then they were going to do Giant Size X-Men number 2.
Mm.
And then Marvel decided to cancel the Giant Size books that they were doing.
Mm.
So it was turned into two issues of X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
So this originally was created to be a one-part double-sized story.
Mm.
And then got turned into two separate issues.
Mm. Mm.
So that may be part of the reason why it doesn't read, it doesn't introduce everything as well as it could do. I think we also have a problem that comes from it being reprinted in 1986.
Okay.
So in 1975, when this comic was made, your average Marvel title was 17 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the average Marvel title is 22 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they got Chris Claremont to write, and they tried to get the same artists in. So this time, Dave Cockrum and Sam Granger to draw additional pages that get slotted in that further explain things or add in little bits of backstory. And that happens here, but they're kind of fighting against themselves.
Yeah.
And it's two things going on at once. It's partly he's trying to just explain it and make it a satisfying story by itself. But also partly he's trying to pick up on things that are mistakes in light of further stories that were written later. So two key things that happen in this story that are rewrites are that when Nightcrawler wants to teleport into the base, you get the whole thing about he can't teleport blind, he might die.
How did
he get there? And they use Banshee's powers. That's all added. Because it becomes a big part of forthcoming stories that he cannot teleport blindly.
Which obviously
just wasn't considered when that story was come out with. The other one that's in there that's quite minor is Storm. In later stories, and actually it's a focus of a story like about two issues later, Storm is claustrophobic and she cannot go into covered up areas. She gets very scared very easily. And they just put like a little thought balloon in of her going, oh, I'm terrified to go into here, but I'd be fine. Because obviously written like 11 years later with the hindsight of one of the key things about this character is she's claustrophobic. They feel the need to kind of go back and explain why she's going into a base that's undercover.
Fair enough, yeah.
That would be claustrophobic. So you've got this kind of, I think it's pulling at itself, which in some ways it's trying to make itself more accessible by trying to explain more. But in some ways that makes it less accessible because you're like, why are you telling me this stuff that doesn't seem relevant to the story?
Thought bubble.
Nowhere. What's it got to do with that? And the whole that whole section with Banshee and Nightcrawler and teleporting, it kind of threw us a bit. It was like, what's all this about? And it's trying to explain things that happen later. And it's almost like, and it's always true that the writer knows more than the reader. That's part of storytelling. But the writer knows 11 years more and is trying to make up for that. And it's just not entirely satisfying for me. I suspect there's something in as well, the fact that the previous issue, not on the reprint, but on the original story, was edited by Len Wein, who co-wrote this, who plotted it. And then this is the first issue where the editor-in-chief of Marvel is Marv Wolfman, a different editor. So I think the fact that the person writing it was kind of leaving Marvel at the time, or leaving being the chief editor, probably led to there being some inconsistency and lack of strength in the writing, I think. But I think there's a lot of things that aren't explained. And one thing we did while you were rereading it, because we read it a while ago and then reread it just before the podcast, I went off and started Googling the Animen because I couldn't remember if they were robots or if they were human beings or if they had powers. And all of that kind of thing in the other 80s books we've read, they've told us that kind of stuff about the villains, sometimes at too much length. Whereas this story, you don't really know what's motivating the villains.
No.
Don't know who they are. It's very much half a story. So I think, for me, I did score accessibility low. I went with a 3 out of 5, which is not terrible, but not great.
Yeah, there's always, I mean, with any, with quite a few comics that we've read, there's always that kind of, why are you being a bad day? What's your, apart from just being a baddie,
I mean, it is.
There's no,
nobody seems to have very much motivation. Some of the X-Men, and most of the motivation is in the bits that are added. And it's in a very like, well, actually what's happening is, it feels like a geek explaining the backstory. It feels a bit like when I explain the backstory to you, rather than it being an organic story.
Yeah, and even, you know, and even, you know, the X-Men themselves, or and any superhero taken out of context, why are they there? So, you know, sort of like, I mean, I guess we're going to jump slightly, but the Proud Star.
Oh, the Beck up story, yeah.
Sort of like that kind of explains his kind of motivations, but nobody else.
Much more so, yeah.
Nobody else has got a motivation, and that's kind of the problem with...
And I think that comes from it being from an earlier period.
Mm.
I think by the 80s, there was an attempt to write up a bit more, you know, to kind of try and make things make sense. And there's weaknesses to that, because you end up over-explaining sometimes, and things become too dependent on what's happened before.
Like prequels to films.
Yeah, it's just every story ends up being about the story, rather than being a story.
Like Logan or something like that. That's kind
yeah,
of,
I suppose so.
It's kind of, you know.
Mm. You're always trying to explain stuff.
Or the end is Star Wars films.
Yeah. So I gave it a 3 out of 5. What were you giving to that first story? For accessibility.
I would... I'm going to give it a 3 as well.
Okay, so we're giving it a 6 out of 10 there. Mm. Let's move on to artwork. What did you think of the Dave Cockrum and Sam Granger artwork in this book?
Not a lot. There were no individual pages or frames that I thought were particularly good. I don't know.
Dave Cockrum is an artist who I quite like his work, and there's an element of nostalgia in there. I read quite a lot of the classic X-Men stuff. Mm. And I'm a fan of the Legion of Superheroes, and I eventually picked up his Legion stuff, which was from before this. And when he drew this, he was a relatively young artist. It was at the beginning of his career. He did the Legion and then basically came over to Marvel. He did like a year of the Legion, came over to Marvel, did a bit of inking, and then became the artist on X-Men.
But you get quite excited by kind of lines and that sort of thing.
I can do. That's is not Dave Cockrum's best work.
Okay.
Definitely not. And I think a lot of people would say, this is me now saying a lot of people would say what I think, but I do think a lot of people would say that Dave Cockrum's real talent was in design.
Okay.
He designed characters well, and they were very distinctive, and the costumes and the silhouettes were unique. And he designed most of these characters. He designed Storm. He designed Nightcrawler.
Okay.
He designed Colossus. He designed... I can't even remember all the characters now.
So there's one frame, for example, where Nightcrawler is doing some... is sonically... boring into the rock to get in.
Oh, that was Benchy trying to get in, and you couldn't tell what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's not the best draftsman.
That's
not his greatest technique. And, I mean, that is one of the panels, so, you know, I've talked already a bit with the writing, that some of it was done in 1975 and some of it was done in 1986. Mm. And that panel was a 1986 one.
Right.
And already by 1986, Dave Cockrum was considered old-fashioned.
Right.
He was new and he was exciting in 1974, 75. And then by 1986, it's like, oh, we're past him.
Mm.
You know, and some of that is about some of the flashy things he does. It's a lot of use of shadow to try and make things look convincing that actually when you look at them, they're not very convincing. If you look at them for a long time, they're actually not very realistic, but they're giving the illusion of realism, which is something a lot of people took from Neil Adams, who's a big hit at the time.
So show me that picture on here, because
I think it's often... more obvious on the page than when you were looking. Irrigay was reading it more in panel by panel view on Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah. So
and actually, when you see it as part of a page, it works better. But then it's part of a page that's split. So in the original comic, we will share this on our, we have a blogspot, shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, and it's pages 6 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
And the top two tiers of page 6 and the bottom tier of page 7 were the original story.
Okay.
With some relettering.
Okay.
And then there's another page worth, which is the bottom bit of page 6 and the top two bits of page 7, which are added in at a later date.
Oh, okay.
So they've added in the explanation of how Nightcrawler can go to a place where he doesn't know what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that has later become a point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the art isn't as good. I think the change in Dave Cockrum and Sam Granger's art as they age doesn't have the same kind of immediacy and excitement that his early stuff had.
Mm.
Which is a bit, it's fudged. It isn't as great as it appears at first.
Mm.
But there's something about the use of shadow, the use of, you know, the way that Nightcrawler's face looks on page 6 compared to on the new bit on page 7. It kind of gives it, it feels more realistic, even though it probably isn't. It's still quite a cartoony interpretation. And for me, it's the inconsistency in the art that lets down this book.
Mm, mm.
You know, the fact that it's combining 11 years apart of one artist puts it lower. So for me, I would give the art in this book, again, a 3... At least in this first story, a 3 out of 5.
Mm.
So I think there's some good elements to it. The design's good.
Mm-hmm.
I think the storytelling is slightly broken by the fact that the pages don't go together how they originally did.
Okay.
Where they filled half a page with one thing and half a page with another.
Mm.
You lose that element of a whole page being designed.
Yeah.
And I think inconsistency. For me, inconsistency is a big problem in a comic. Unless it has a purpose.
Mm.
So I don't have a problem within this comic of Dave Cockrum drawing one story and John Bolton drawing another story, and they're very different styles because they're very different stories. They're about the same thing, but from very different viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind that. And you can sometimes use multiple artists in a story to do different bits of the story to give it...
Okay.
To encourage storytelling.
Yeah.
But I don't like inconsistency where you're telling one story in one place.
Mm.
You know, and I know I had problems when we looked at the Web of Spider-Man issue and it had clearly been inked by lots of different inkers.
Right, right.
And it would change slightly from page to page, and that annoys me more than going, oh, do you know what we're going to do? If they'd done all of the bits where they were outside the mountain by one artist and then all the bits inside the mountain by a different artist, to me, I would find that less jarring than differences within a page. How did you feel about art? What would you have given it?
I'd have probably given it a 3.
3 as well? Yeah. So we're not being hugely negative. It's just it's not blowing our socks off.
No. No, it's not like, wow, this is amazing.
So the next one's characterisation. Mm-hmm. What are you going to give out of 5 for characterisation?
I'm going to give it, I think all the X-Men are well defined.
Mm.
We know who they are. We know, you know, costume-wise, we know their kind of reason for being. We know what their kind of powers are, and possibly, we care about it.
I guess. I mean, we did have a conversation before we started recording.
Mm.
We were talking about what motivates the characters and how, to a large extent, particularly the villain. You don't really know what motivates them.
No.
And actually, you know, in many ways you still don't after reading it. And even the heroes, you can see there's a little bit of that within the dialogue of them kind of tussling with each other and disagreeing with each other. Yeah. And I think this is where you're starting to see that the writer, the plotter, and the scripter were different people.
Mm.
So in the plot, in the action of what happens, it's very traditional superhero. Mm. It's very much, it's like an Avengers story or a Justice League story or a Fantastic Four story. It's about a superhero team. Mm. They all can do different things. Mm. They're fighting these villains who can all do different things. Mm. There's some one-on-ones, there's some where they're in groups of twos.
Mm.
But then in the writing, they're adding in the like little bits of like all Wolverine and Thunderbird. Maybe there's a bit of a tension there. Mm. The fact that Cyclops is telling everyone what to do, that to me feels like it's more in dialogue than anything else.
Right.
So, I don't know. It almost feels like they're trying to add characterization after. And I think some of that is coming from the bits that were 11 years later, not the original story.
Okay.
So again, I probably would give it a 3 again. You know, it's kind of middling. But yeah. I do think when you compare it to pure Chris Claremont, and in fairness, you're talking about the 1975 story was written when he was 25.
Mm.
The 1986 story, he's 36.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's a better writer by the time he's 36.
Mm.
And that second story, the characterization, is there throughout. It's there through the actions characters take as well as what they think and say.
Sure, sure.
And I think in the first one, it's mainly there in what they think and say.
Mm.
It's not there so much in their actions.
No.
So, yeah, it's not terrible, but 3. Again, middling.
Mm. Yeah.
What did you give it?
I'm going to give it a 4.
Oh, you're being more generous than me.
Mm.
Now, the next thing we normally score is the cover.
Mm.
And I think to follow through the way we're doing it, maybe we should just look at the cover from 1975.
Okay.
Which is that one there by penciler Gil Kane and inker. So Dave Cockrum is inking it. That one.
Oh, okay.
One on the right. The all new, all different X-Men, number 95.
Okay.
For 25 cents. By Gil Kane and Dave Cockrum.
Okay.
What do you think of that cover?
Very busy. I don't like busy covers.
It is very busy, but actually, I think it's really well done.
Okay.
And I think this is something that shows Gil Kane was a much more accomplished artist at that point than Dave Cockrum was.
Okay.
And was very accomplished at layouts. And you've got things happening in 3 different planes. Actually 4, because you've got Nightcrawler down there. I missed it first. You've got 4 different fights going on. And I think they clearly are separated from each other.
Okay.
I think it's quite a good cover. I think they could make it clearer through the colouring, but ultimately I think it's pretty good.
Mm.
I would give that a 4 for that cover, 4 out of 5.
Okay. Is she supposed to look like a ray?
I suppose so. With her cloak out, Storm can look a bit like a ray. It's got that thing where it's attached to the back of her knickers somehow. It is, and it comes out as 2 like heart semicircles.
Like when you go to the toilet and you forget to. Yeah.
I think it's very dynamic, it's very powerful, it's very action orientated.
Okay.
And they're all words. Gil Kane, that's what he's about.
Mm.
But he was always more about, particularly in the 70s, he did a lot of cover layouts for Marvel.
Mm.
And then other people drew the cover. So what you get here is you get the power and the layout of Gil Kane, which is better than the layout of Dave Cockrum.
Mm.
But then you've got the kind of finish, the artistry of Dave Cockrum, which at the time was quite fashionable and has got a real kind of... It gives kind of a weight and a realism.
Who's he punching then?
He's punching Catman.
Where's Catman? Oh, is that
Catman's there. Oh, Catman's face. Bottom left-hand corner.
Oh, okay.
So he's punched Catman. Thunderbird's fighting Catman. Colossus is fighting Gorilla Man. Mm. Storm is fighting Dragonfly. And in the background, we've got Nightcrawler fighting Frogman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So once it's explained, I think it's quite a good cover.
I think it's quite fun. I mean, it's not the greatest thing you've ever seen.
No.
But it's good, fun, well drawn. I gave it 4 out of 5.
Okay. I'll give it 4 out of 5 as well.
You think that's worth it?
Okay. Yeah.
So far that first story has got, what's that? Let's see. 27.
Mm-hmm.
But then we've got to take off points for things that were acceptable in the 80s, but actually on this story acceptable in the 70s.
Mm.
Is there anything you would have taken points off for?
I suppose... Well, there's the Native American.
The depiction of the Native or Indigenous American character is unfortunate and is...
Mm.
And actually, you know, I said Dave Cockrum was a great comic book costume designer.
Mm. Mm.
But the design of him is also slightly... It uses shortcuts, you know, the feathers and the hair and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, not entirely unnecessary or unrealistic shortcuts, but they're still shortcuts.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think... I just feel... For me, I would take off 2 points for that.
Okay. I'll and I think probably...
Would you take anything off, or...?
Yeah, let's take one off.
So that's 3 off between us, so we're giving it 24 on the first story.
Mm-hmm.
Like the 1970s story. Let's look at the 1980s story. Mm. So, this was the one we've already given away that we like this more.
Mm.
So let's go through the story. The story is called Morning. With a double meaning, maybe, because it's that early in the morning, but it's about a funeral.
Oh. Thunder all through the night. Promise to see Jesus in the morning light. Take my hand, it'll be alright. Come on, save your soul tonight.
Professor X and the X-Men have come to New Mexico to bury one of their own. Xavier muses that he has often sent the X-Men out to battle, and finally his luck has run out. One of the X-Men hasn't returned. Jean Grey joins the Professor and they talk about the emotional toll of sharing in someone's death. They're interrupted by a cry from Colossus. Thunderbird's body has been taken. The Minister wants to call the police, but Cyclops says the X-Men will find him. John Proudstar's parents ask them to just go, but Wolverine goes to track the body and the other X-Men follow. As they follow, each of the X-Men remembers conversations and interactions with Thunderbird, all of them wondering why he was so unreachable. Wolverine witnesses Thunderbird's younger brother holding a traditional funeral for John Proudstar. He walks away, so therefore he doesn't witness James Proudstar swearing revenge on Xavier and the X-Men. Short 8-page backup.
Yeah.
And actually, when you describe what happens, it's very little.
Mm.
Because what happens is characterization.
Yeah.
We both enjoyed this much better.
We did.
And I think there's various reasons for that. Number one, Chris Claremont was a much greater writer in 1986 than he was in 1975. As you would expect. John Bolton, at this point, has been a professional comics artist for longer than Dave Cockrum had when he drew the first one.
Mm, mm.
So he's a stronger talent himself.
Mm.
So you've got a stronger, more kind of accomplished team working together on the project. And I think the key thing, though, is everything makes sense from the point of view of each character. You know, the motivations of everybody affect what's going on. You enjoyed it a lot, didn't you?
I did. I thought it was well drawn. I kind of like the... There's a building in it, and... well, there are several buildings, but there's one...
Well, I think there's one main building. They then go out into the desert, don't they? It's almost like a disused town, isn't it?
And I sort of feel that there's kind of almost photojournalism in there somewhere. Mm. So, you know, that they've found a real building and they've just drawn over...
I imagine that...
they've drawn over the building, maybe. Or they've...
Yeah, I imagine
they've been
that
inspired by...
John Bolton was... I mean, John Bolton's British.
Right.
So I doubt he has that much or had that much experience in New Mexico, but who knows? But I imagine he looked at photos of the area and, you know, really tried to create the kind of desolation that you might get.
I'm thinking, I think, sort of like, and I think, like, unlike the previous story, there was quite a lot of a sense of place. You really knew where you were. And kind of sort of like, and you could feel the heat by the colours or...
Yeah, the colours and the way the art was drawn and the way the characters were moving. I think that was there. I think as well, you know, the decision to choose a desolate part of New Mexico for when the characters are feeling desolate.
Yeah.
You know, also it grounds a landscape which...
Yeah.
It's a story about native practices, which would ground the landscape into the story, into life.
Totally.
You know, it's the place where it takes place is part of the story. You know, and the X-Men being very hot, and also the X-Men choosing to continue following the body, even though it's very uncomfortable for a lot of them. But then the way that they act, the fact that Storm brings a shower to cool them down because she's aware that they're in need and she wants to help her, the people she's with. You know, it's a, it is a very...
human. It feels like a much more human story.
Incredibly human.
And I get more from those sorts of stories than I do from, you know, from another fight, which is always a problem with them.
Yeah, with superhero books. And I think that is a key to why, by the mid-80s, X-Men was the top-selling comic book.
Right.
You know, Chris Claremont was considered quite a soap opera-y kind of writer. And it was about the characters, and it was about, you know, how they reacted in situations. And how they interacted with each other was what the stories were ultimately about. The villains that come in and go out and the things like that, they're often quite peripheral. It's more about how the characters react to it. And, you know, these stories in classic X-Men, if you read the whole run, and I've got quite a lot of the issues, not all of them, and I have the collection of the second half. It's very difficult to get the first half collection now, but the second half, where they just collect the backup stories. The point of the stories was to do personal short stories that are about character. It's less about incident. And they were all very like this. And partly that's because that's John Bolton's strength as an artist, and he's writing to the strength of his artist. But also partly because by then, that's really what Chris Claremont cared about. You know, and... Chris Claremont never would have written a story with Count Nefaria in.
Right, right, okay.
You know, that was something that came from Len Wein. It's like, oh, let's take this old villain and plop him in.
Yeah.
You know, whereas for Chris Claremont, there's always thematic link. There's always... there's always something else going on. And I think this really does work. It's very satisfying in a way. Should we talk about scoring on this story?
Yeah. Yeah.
So accessibility out of 5. How accessible was it?
More so than the previous one.
It was definitely. Every character's name is given.
Yeah.
Every character, you know their motivation. You know who they are, where they are, why they're there.
Absolutely.
And that is very clear. And the connections between the places are much more linked. You know, when they're in that base in the first story, they could be anywhere. They're just like going through these motions. So yeah, I think it's much more accessible. What would you go for? You gave the first story a 3.
I'd give this a 4.
You'd give it a 4. Yeah, I would too. I think we're going 4 again there. Artwork out of 5.
A 4 again.
4. Okay, I gave it a 5 for artwork. No doubt in my mind. I think John Bolton is one of the greatest comic book artists of all time.
Okay.
I think his stuff sometimes loses something in printing.
Yeah.
You don't get the subtleties, but I just think his stuff is beautiful.
Okay, well, I'm going to give it a 5 then.
Are you increasing? You can stick with a 4.
Wondering,
because it would get 9 out of 10 from the two of us.
I just didn't want to overshoot my load, as it were.
So you want to change that to a 5?
Yeah.
I think it's breathtaking, and I think it's the combination. It's the combination of artist John Bolton, but also colourist Glynis Oliver.
Colours are very good.
The colours are very good, and they work very well with the art. Yeah, it's about that combination. Colour,
that's what you get heat, you get
place. Yeah, and the colour gives a lot of the mood, and it gives the heat, and the, you know, there's so much happening with colour.
Yeah, you can
visualize. Even down to that last, you know, the use of purple for background colours at times, you know, when people are feeling, and the red at the end, there's like a really strong red in the background when he's like saying, I'm going to be vengeful.
I am.
It's really, I just think it's beautifully done.
Okay.
Beautifully done. So I gave it a 5.
Okay.
Characterisation out of 5.
So
we've already talked about characterisation. Yeah. And that's what we loved about that story.
Yeah, so again, I would give it a 5.
Yeah, I also went 5, so 10 out of 10 on that as well. This is a strong story. Now, the cover.
Okay.
So, if we talk about the cover just for that story, Ben.
I like that.
I like that. I don't think it's as strong as the story.
Oh. No, but
I think John Bolton is better at character than he is at iconic poses. So I think trying to create something, but I do like, the best thing about it is, and you know, again, look on the blogspot we have, shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, see
half.
A picture of this. The way that James Proudstar, the younger Thunderbird, is holding
onto
a ghostly image of his brother, kind of keeping him away from the X-Men.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, that's got real character in it, but then the characters just walking along are a bit, I think it would have been a stronger character if it had just been the two Thunderbirds.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, I agree with you.
But it's still great. I would give that a 4.
And the top image is a bit homoerotic as well.
Well, they're brothers, so it's not homoerotic when two brothers are cuddling. Okay, what are you giving that out of 5?
I'm going to give that a 4.
Yeah.
A four. Yeah.
And acceptable in the 80s, my choice would be to take 1 off. Because I think there's still a certain, I just think it's quite a clumsy rendering of Native Americans.
It is.
It's more respectful than the stuff in the first story.
Yeah.
But it's not quite there. Would you take anything off, or would you not?
I would take 1 off if I was being, I mean, it's a 6. How many pages did you say? 6, 5.
8 pages.
It's difficult to put a whole kind of, you know, backstory of, you know, sort of Native Americans, you know, funerals and all of that. Malarkey. And if I'd have been a kid, I'd have been interested in why. I would have maybe gone to research, so, you know.
why. And I imagine there's more research in this than in the other one.
Pyres and that sort of thing, as opposed to sort of holes that we do.
I do think, though, that, you know, I think that maybe it didn't really explain why characters who were not living, you know, the pictures of the parents.
Yeah.
They are clearly not, they are clearly Native American, but they're Native Americans who are living in a modern society.
Yeah.
They are not trying to recreate, they don't look stereotypical Native American.
No. And that's good, isn't it?
Their sons have both decided to take on the trappings of... It doesn't quite make sense to me, and I think it needs some explanation.
And isn't that often the case, though?
Well, possibly.
That, you know, that young people often, you know, like all of those people who go, you know, join ISIS or whatever.
Mm. Finally, the one thing we haven't talked about, we talked about covers.
Yeah.
We talked about two covers.
Yeah.
But there is a third cover on this book, which is the actual cover of the comic, which is the one with the border. It's drawn by Arthur Adams. It's coloured by George Roussos. Mm. And it's a close-up picture of Storm as she looked back in the 70s, so with big hair and, like, the kind of more kind of goddess look, because we saw her in the X-Men book we did before, where she had kind of a punky look with a mohawk and wearing leather.
Could we have the audio for everyone? It's Dennis Roussos.
Is it that 70s that you think everyone...
No, you know.
Oh, I like Dennis Roussos.
That'll probably be complete.
Yeah, it does seem a bit out of nowhere, darling. But we're looking at that picture and we're judging this cover.
Sorry, a random piece of clip of that, but nobody outside.
Yeah, for no particular reason. I'm not going to be sharing that.
Well, that's just because you said sort of Roussos. There was someone who's called Roussos.
Oh, George Roussos.
Yes.
See, but I've mentioned George Roussos on every single one of these podcasts because he was Marvel's cover colourist and he coloured all of them. And you've never made a Dennis Roussos joke before now.
I'd never made the link.
Oh, I like George Roussos as a colourist. Fascinating man, actually, George Roussos. It was...
There are probably other people called Roussos as well.
There probably are, yeah. But
for people in the UK...
You know, George Roussos, like, drew some of the second ever Batman comic. And then he's colouring covers in the 80s. It's, like, really bizarre how long his career was.
But then it's Roussos.
And how varied. So let's talk about this cover. Arthur Adams. I know, you're going to make that into another Adams, aren't you? Brian Adams, Arthur. Everything I do it for you.
No, I was going, Arthur!
Arthur! Bit of Will-o'-the-Wisp there.
Would anybody mind if I turn this next track up? Because it's my favourite, it's forever and ever. And I'd like us all to hear it. Anybody mind?
Oh, poor Arthur.
So we're looking at this cover, here again.
Right, yeah, sorry.
And we get to score it, and then the podcast can finish before we die.
Concentrate.
And before the listeners die of boredom.
With our cultural references from the 80s and
70s. 70s, mainly.
I like... No.
This cover.
Yes. It's all right.
It is... I quite like it.
Yeah.
The logo, the classic X-Men logo, is by Ken Lopez.
Okay.
Great logo based on the Jim Steranko designed X-Men logo, but made to look more classic.
Mm-hmm.
Very cleverly done.
Logo.
There's a main image of Storm by Arthur Adams. It's very Arthur Adams and it's very 80s, I think.
But she's not the main...
She's not the main character, but with the team, whoever you pick. You know, the X-Men story we did, was Wolverine the main character in that story?
No, but you could have...
But he was in it. You could have picked any of them, and they've chosen Storm for this.
But you could have had the Native American. I mean, that's the point of those stories.
Yeah, I think Thunderbird would have been a more appropriate to the story choice. I can understand why, from an editorial standpoint, Marvel chose not to go with Thunderbird.
Okay.
they chose to go with Storm, who was probably the second most popular X-Man after Wolverine.
Okay.
And they've put Wolverine on the other one.
Okay.
And probably the other popular character within this story is Cyclops, but he's on the cover of the X-Factor issue we did.
Okay, so, yeah.
So I can understand why they went with Storm. And, you know, also the fact that it's the old-fashioned look of Storm that isn't around anymore. And she's down there as well. She's in the border with her punk look.
Okay.
In fact, she's dead in the middle on the punk look there.
But
it's the very, very big 80s hair and the very starey eyes.
Yeah.
It's very Arthur Adams. It's good.
Yeah.
I think it's very good, actually. I would give that a 4 out of 5.
Okay, I'm going to give that a 3 out of 5.
Okay.
We're going to disagree.
Altogether, really, we've got to make a decision.
Mainly because I don't really understand what's happening with her hair and her...
Well, her hair's just big and floating behind her.
And is her head headband sticking up, or is it like...
Oh, it's sticking up. It's a 3D thing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, there are some pictures. I don't know if there's any inside on this particular issue.
And he seems to have given up on her dress.
Well, that's part of her cloak.
Oh, okay.
And then you can't see the rest.
Okay, but I'm not, I'm not convinced.
You're not convinced. I quite like it, but it's okay. So what we have to decide is when we're going to put this into our ranking of the Bordered 25th Anniversary issues.
Yes.
Do we do an average of the two and take that as a score?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we do the two stories separately? Because there's quite a difference.
Mm-hmm.
The 1970s story we gave 24.
Okay.
And the 1980s story we gave an average. We gave 34.
Okay, so that would be 30 with it.
As an average. 58, what's half of 58? 25 plus 3. 28 would be the average.
28, okay. Should we do that then?
Give it an average of 28?
Yeah, because otherwise...
Is that right? Have I done my maths right there? Shall I use a calculator, my darling?
I would, but then I'm...
Yeah, let's use my calculator in case I got my average wrong in my head.
I'm completely innumerate, though.
Well, I'm not completely innumerate, but I'm not always the best.
I am.
No, that's not right.
I thought it was 30. Hi, Bums. Are you coming to be on our podcast?
29 is the average, not 28. 29. So it's closer to 30.
Mm.
So if we give it the average of 29, it's near the bottom. Mm. It's equal with the issue of Spider-Man we did.
Oh, no. Okay.
So number one is Thor still, the issue of Thor we did, with 38 points, then the Avengers with 37, then Conan, which did surprisingly well, but I'd never read that story before, and I really enjoyed it when we read it, that got 32 points, then Daredevil got 31.5, Uncanny X-Men got 31, we would have a joint next place, which is place, what's that two for? Place 6, which is between Amazing Spider-Man and this issue of Classic X-Men. Then Fantastic Four, then Web of Spider-Man, and at the bottom, X-Factor, which just did so badly because of all of the racist names of the characters that we had to take points off. So we will put it in there, yeah?
Yeah.
So, and Classic X-Men.
Catch joined us.
Currently at place 6. Joint 6th place, so then out of 10 of these Bordered comics we've done so far.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, near the bottom, but it's not terrible. And actually, if we were to just go off the second story, which we gave 34 points to, this would be in 3rd place. So, I don't know quite what the point is. I would recommend people buy it. The question on the name of the podcast is, should I love this comic? My answer is yes. Should I love this comic? Should I love bits of this comic? Is it like a curate's egg?
It's one saving grace, is the short story.
The backup story. It's definitely worth, if you have Marvel Unlimited, it's worth reading that backup story at
for
least.
For that.
Because you're not paying any extra for it.
For that alone.
Yeah. But it might not be worth buying the whole comic just for an 8-page story.
Yeah.
I don't know if people would charge you more for a back issue of it than for a new. If you were to buy a modern comic, I don't quite know.
But yeah, it's not just for that nice
story. I think that backup is well worth it, isn't it? Well, to me.
Yeah.
And I would say, should I love this comic? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But maybe with a few
caveats.
Exactly. So on that bombshell.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening. We've managed to get under an hour.
Well done, us.
I know, and that was talking about two stories. We're getting better at this.
We are.
Slightly more focused, even though we do still go off about Demis Roussos for a bit. I like Demis Roussos. She would like to hear Demis Roussos.
Sorry. Poor Bumble.
I know, our poor cat has to listen to us doing bad impressions all the time. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back hopefully fairly soon. Sorry it's been so long since the last episode. We've had a bit of a bad start to the year.
Yeah.
I would say I am now an orphan, but as of yet, I've not been adopted by Batman to become Robin. So
you're
that's
a bit
good
old.
News. How dare you? I'm younger than Dick Grayson. He was created in 1940.
Yes, but he does like young boys-ish, kind of. Perhaps.
What?
Well, I mean, sort of like, I mean, the Robins are all like 12, aren't they?
16. Well, Dick Grayson was created in 1940. That was like decades ago.
Yeah, but he's probably dead now.
He's over 80.
He's probably dead now.
No, he's not. He's Nightwing.
Is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right, anyway, we will speak to you all again soon.
Right.
And take care of yourself. See you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.